Okay, this is good, though. We're off to a good start.
We are.
I mean, we're raring to go.
We have a lot to get through,
yes.
I feel.
Yes.
Some of it is good.
Some of it is very good.
And some of it is what it is.
Yep. Hi, kittens. It's episode 9 of Purter, She Wrote.
Yay!
I'm Dana LaCoco.
And I am Sunshine Lamontri.
Welcome back to our Cozy Cat Mystery Podcast. And holy smokes, we've got a book to talk about this week.
Before we talk about this book,
yes,
we would like to remind you to keep our spirits going.
Yes.
To boost morale.
That would be great.
Could you please rate, review, and or subscribe, whatever works.
That would be stupendous. Follow us on Purter, She Wrote.
Say hi.
Yes.
Tell us what books you love.
I know. We want to hear it.
Show us pictures of your cats.
Please. I wonder if maybe, like, we should show more pictures of our cats.
Maybe.
I don't know. Tweet at us. Do you want to see pictures of our cats?
We want
to see
know.
Pictures of your cats. But it's at Purter, She Wrote across all the major platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Our website.
PurterSheWrote.com.
Gmail.
Yep. All that good stuff.
Get at us.
Yes. Oh, man.
All right.
What a book.
So we read the first in the Cat Who series. We read The Cat Who Could Read Backwards.
Now, the reason we decided to switch gears and read this book, because we had identified a couple other books that we were planning on reading on our reading list on our website.
Apologies if you were following that and you read a different book instead of this one.
We will cover everything that we talked about on our reading list, but this was a special case.
Yes.
If you'll recall back to episode 7, The Cats That Surfed the Web.
By Ms. Karen Ann Golden.
Yes. Well, we noticed when we parsed through Amazon's reviews that some people seemed to think that Karen Ann Golden was perhaps picking up her ideas from someone else, namely the author of this book,
right.
Lillian Jackson Braun.
Right. So her series, Karen Ann Golden's series, The Cats That.
Yes.
Some people thought that was maybe like a pickup of The Cat Who series.
I mean,
it's pretty close.
Not only are the titles close, there is a Siamese cat featured prominently in both series.
Right.
So it looks like we had a mystery of our own to solve.
Right. We needed to know.
Yes.
Is this a case of...
Is it
light plagiarism?
Is it a case of heavy plagiarism? Who knows? We got to check this out. We've got to get to the bottom of this. And, dear listeners, we did. In my professional opinion, I do not think that Karen Ann Golden plagiarized these books.
No, I don't think so either. I think that maybe she read them once when she was younger.
I feel like if she had plagiarized from these, her books would be a lot better.
Yeah.
But they're not.
Do you want to hear a little bit about the author, Lillian Jackson Braun?
I absolutely do.
Because I have some information about her.
Oh, good.
So, Lillian Jackson Braun was born in 1913.
We should mention that this book, The Cat Who Could Read Backwards, is the first in a series of 29 books.
Mm-hmm.
This book was published in 1966.
Yeah.
So, if y'all were worried that Lillian Jackson Braun was, like, maybe a witch, she's...
She's probably the mother of the Cozy Cat Mystery.
Okay, cool.
If we want to think of her like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. She's like the OG Cozy Cat Mystery writer.
She was like, let me start something.
I love it. All right, so what else did Lillian
Okay, so she was born in 1913, and unfortunately she passed away in 2011. She was 97 years old.
That's a good run.
Yeah. So she started writing when she was a teenager, and she contributed sports poetry to the Detroit News.
Wow.
Yeah, sports poetry.
I had no idea that that was a thing that a newspaper would publish.
I'm not sure I've ever read sports poetry.
I'm going to put that on a list of, like, things to Google.
Like, war poetry, sure.
Right.
Love poetry, definitely.
Yeah.
But sports poetry?
I don't think of sports as very poetic unless it's something like, I don't know, figure skating?
I should know more. I studied this, but I don't.
It's okay.
She also went on to write advertising copy for many of Detroit's department stores.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, and then she worked for the Detroit Free Press, which is a great newspaper. She worked as the Good Living editor for 30 years and then retired in 1978. So while she was still working, she published these first three novels between 1966 and 1968. Mm-hmm. And then nothing for 18 years.
18?
She was like, no, I'm happy with my life. I have a full-time fulfilling job. Right. I don't have time to be writing these cat cozy books.
Right. I got to be the Good Living editor, which sounds like basically like being a Martha Stewart.
I think that's essentially what she was.
I mean, that Good Living editor to me is like, oh, you know, I've got to review like a bunch of scented candles.
Or tell
like,
you where to go on vacation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That yeah. sounds like a sweet job.
I am a little bit envious.
Yeah.
So she stops that. She's married. She has a great job. She's happy. Mm-hmm. And she's not writing these books. Or is she?
What?
Because in 1986... a new publishing group picks her up again, and in the first 2 years, they release four books of hers.
Really?
And then between 1986 and 2007, they release the rest of her 29, yeah.
Wow.
All of her novels.
So she was working on them on the sly for 18 years.
I think so.
Either
so what happened?
She's adopted like a prolific... almost Patricia Fry-esque. Like,
she retired and she was like, you know what?
Yeah.
This has been building up.
Giving myself the gift of fiction.
So she published all those. Her last one was in 2007. It was called The Cat Who Had 60 Whiskers. There was actually a 30th novel planned that she was in the middle of writing. And she said that she died with one regret. This was reported by her husband of 33 years, her second husband.
Right.
Her one regret in life was that she was unable to finish her last novel.
Oh.
Because fans so wanted it. And that's true. I actually came across a blog post from, like, some mystery website. They were like, what happened to the 30th novel?
Oh,
where is
no.
it? What's the next one?
You think they'd be able to, like, go straight or finish it?
I don't
like
know.
Like how Brandon Sanderson finished the rest of Wheel of Time. You'd think there would be someone out there that could... That
the
could
torch be the, of Lillian Jackson Braun.
Because, I mean, how many Wheel of Time books are there? Maybe this is like the Wheel of Time of Cozy Cat Mysteries.
It's possible. But alas, no one has done that since she died in 2011.
Well, we can still hope.
Yeah. So that was basically her life. She was a cool lady.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to raise one up for Lillian.
Cheers.
Cheers
to Lillian.
Thank you for all you did. I do want to talk about these books. You know, you can get the Kindle copy on Amazon, but we actually sprung for the paperback copies.
Something good about reading a paperback.
Yes! I gotta say, we were each sent a different edition, I guess. Mine, you know, it's a handsome orange pocket paperback. It's got a cool dagger with some bloody cat paw prints on the front. Very intriguing. But Sunshine, the copy they sent you, I have a lot of questions.
So it's this bright pink sort of fuchsia cover. It has in the top left-hand corner the suggestion of like a tube of paint being squeezed.
Which makes
and,
sense.
Yeah.
It's
about the
art
world.
Right.
Yeah. And some black paw prints and the dagger, of course, which is an element of the plot.
Yes.
And then very mysteriously, two vote buttons.
Right.
Suggesting there might be an election.
Or like a political angle.
Right.
There's not.
There's not.
Not once.
At all. Why are these on the book cover?
That is a mystery in and of itself.
Did the designer not read the book?
Probably not.
Probably not.
I'm going to go ahead and say no. But you think someone along the process would have been like, Harry, wait a second.
There's... Yeah. So why'd you pick voting buttons?
Yeah, right. I don't think there's any political figures
no.
in this book. No local elections.
No.
No mayors.
There is a mention in the very, very beginning that the main character reads an article about the gubernatorial race.
Oh, true.
But it's literally just one small mention in the very beginning, which makes me think that the designer read the first page.
Oh, no, probably.
And was like, all right, I got it.
Like, sweet, I got it. Leave it to me.
Yeah.
I got it.
Don't worry about it. Great cover coming up.
Yep.
Man.
Well, So let's go off the book's description.
Yeah.
Lest we give away too much of the plot. But our book is The Cat Who Could Read Backwards. The world of modern art is a mystery to many, but for Jim Quillerin, it turns into a mystery of another sort when his assignment to cover the art beat for the Daily Fluxion leads down the path to murder. A stabbing in an art gallery, vandalized paintings, a fatal fall from scaffolding. This is not at all what Quillerin expects when he turns his reportorial. Didn't realize that was a word. Talents to art. But now Quillerin and his newly found partner, Coco the Brilliant Siamese, are back in their element, sniffing out clues and confounding criminals intent on mayhem and murder.
Dun dun dun. What did the people think of this book?
Well, let me tell you.
Oh, please do.
So, Amazon readers, by and large, had a lot of love for this series.
Mm-hmm.
I think many people, you know, enjoyed reading the first books when they came out and were really happy when the rest of the series was picked back up again many years later. So for the most part, people describe this book as intriguing, a light mystery, like reconnecting with an old friend. I particularly liked this review here, 5-star review, by Seals4MC. I've read a few of the Cat Who books before and thoroughly enjoyed them. This was the first time I had ever seen the first book for sale. Always wanted to know how Quillerin actually got Coco. Never really had a good picture in my mind of how Quillerin looked. Now I picture him as Tom Selleck with his beautiful mustache.
Yep.
5 out of 5 stars.
Nailed it.
That mustache is practically a
character. I can't wait to talk about that mustache.
Yes. Another glowing review. 5 out of 5 stars. Cat Who? You bet. When my husband accidentally returned this book to the library instead of one of my books, he was heartbroken, as we have the entire Cat Who collection in cassette and books. The library couldn't find it, and the head librarian suggested I try leaving some cheese around, and maybe Coco would come back. Didn't work, but Amazon had copies, so we again have the whole Cat Who collection. It's a fun read. 5 out of 5 stars.
Well, of course Coco wouldn't come back for cheese. No. You should have left pate out.
Yes. Coco has a very, very exceptional palate.
Refined taste.
So, again, by and large, people love this series. People love this book. And then I found probably the saltiest review I have ever read.
Which is shocking. Considering some of the stuff we have read.
Truly shocking. However, I think this person was referring more to the series as a whole.
Okay.
But they're not a fan.
All right.
1 out of 5 stars. Yawn. Not worth waking the kiddies over. Having never read The Cat Who before, I picked it up as a light read. I think I will just skip the previous 20. Good God. And any that appear like little dead kitty love presents in the future. Perhaps it's because I don't find small town dynamics at all interesting. Maybe it's because I couldn't care less about homey little hobbies, like dog cart racing or knitting. It could also be my own 2 Siamese have more personality than Coco and Yum Yum. The names alone are enough to give you a hairball. Maybe my undying love for good mysteries, like the X-Files,
sorry, go on,
caused me to set higher standards. Whatever the reason, I found this book boring, banal, and poorly written, with virtually no plot. I knew it wouldn't be the most intelligent read. I'd like to point out here that intelligent is spelled wrong.
Oh, it's a beautiful detail.
But even without high hopes, I was sorely disappointed. I suggest that unless the potential reader is a blue-haired grandma with a love of small-town nostalgia, Lake Wobegon-esque, they should just keep looking. My geriatric cat wouldn't even let me line his litter box with the pages.
Oh!
All these flavors, and this person chose salt.
Oh! Damn, that last line.
I think that was needlessly cruel.
Oh, I feel like I'm sweating. Yes. Just having listened to that.
Also, that one was published in 1999. So, I'm glad that they're not insulting this poor deceased woman and her life's work.
Oh, my God.
But what a review! Just scathing.
Oh, my God. I feel like Mount Clemens himself wrote it.
I also thought that. From beyond the grave.
Oh, man. Ugh. Reaching a salty, withered corpse hand.
Yes.
Right into the Amazon review box.
Man, the internet is just, it's just a toilet sometimes.
I just tell you, no one could look Lillian Jackson Braun in the face and say that to her.
No, there is a lovely author portrait in the back of the paperback copy that I got. And she looks great. She has these large plastic-framed round glasses. She's rocking some hoop earrings and a flowy, flowery blouse. And, like, you know what? Lillian looks, she looks fun.
There were some other portraits I saw when I was researching her where she's younger and she looks not exactly glamorous, but, like, very, very well done.
I mean, if she was editing a section of the newspaper about good living,
she would have to be.
She was truly living her best life.
Well, I can't say that I agree with that last review, even though I appreciate the savagery of it.
Yes.
All right.
Well, we should get into our cozy rubric.
Let's talk about our cozy rubric.
I mean, as the one review indicated, we'll start with our main character, who's Jim Quillerin.
He's a dude, our first dude.
Yes.
By the way.
A dude who the one reviewer imagined to be Tom Selleck with his beautiful mustache.
That is kind of how I saw him, too.
I also pictured him as, like, a Magnum P.I.-esque character. But also, like, a little older and dorkier, more like a Ned Flanders Magnum P.I. crossover.
Yeah.
I didn't think he was supposed to be, like, a suave dude.
I think he imagined himself to be quite suave.
Yes.
Being a former, like, crime reporter.
Right.
But has since come down in life, being divorced, and I don't know, there's some hint that maybe he was, like, chased away from his last job.
Right.
Or, like, fell on hard times.
I think he might be, like, a recovering alcoholic. But that's our main character, our hero, Jim Quillerin. Great name. Mm-hmm. Also, worth reading the first line of this book.
Oh, please.
Jim Quillerin, whose name had confounded typesetters and proofreaders for 2 decades, arrived 15 minutes early for his appointment with the managing editor of the Daily Fluxion. A+ first sentence.
Love it.
Great name. I think his mustache is almost a character in and of itself.
It was my favorite part. And there is a specific point where I contemplated, like, is this mustache sentient? Like, does it have its own personality?
It certainly was, like, that's where his spidey senses were concentrated. Yes. The mustache stands at attention. It tingles. It sends him vibes.
Yeah. So my favorite one was, it's a short line. It's very direct. It's Quillerin's mustache sprang to attention.
Yes.
Like, it did what?
Yeah. Bing. Bing.
There's another one. He's always parting it thoughtfully or, like, stroking it sadly.
Yes.
Like, it's the recipient of all his manly emotions.
The mustache has a lot of, really a full range of emotions.
There's another one, right, page 5, like, right off the bat. Quillerin's twitching mustache was trying to say, "Who the hell wants a nice clean beat?" But its owner maintained a diplomatic silence.
Man, he's at war with his own mustache.
Yeah. I mean, if that's not a masculine struggle, I can't imagine.
I mean, having never had a mustache, I can't relate, but it sounds like it's a really fascinating experience.
Yeah.
I'd say being that this is a cozy cat mystery, the cat is of crucial importance.
Right.
And what a great cat we have in this book.
I would agree.
Yes.
So, Coco, whose name is something I can't quite pronounce.
I think it's like Cowl Kokung.
Yeah. It's after a 13th century Chinese artist, yes. I believe.
Yes. Which Quillerin, in his rough around the edges, not cultured art critic ways, just shortens it to Coco.
Yeah, I love when they're like, hey, we want you to be our, to do the art column, mm-hmm. be our art reporter. And he's like, well, I don't know, the Statue of Liberty from the Mona Lisa, what's art?
Right, yeah. What is it? They're like, that's what we want. We need someone with a fresh perspective.
Someone who doesn't know what they're doing.
Yep, which I can't think of any professional situation I've ever walked into where the higher-ups were like, no, we actually want someone with very little knowledge.
Well, except maybe the presidency.
Very true. Oh, God.
So kill us true, now.
Please.
So Coco.
Coco's great. I loved the descriptions of Coco. He's very regal. At one point, you know, he's described as kind of prancing up the stairs and his feet are like musical notes
with tiny
little dark paws and slender legs. I feel like Lillian Jackson Braun must have lived with cats because she totally nails their different meows, like the insistent meow, like, feed me! Yes. Versus, like, the sad, you know, I'm lonely.
Yeah.
And we get a whole range of emotions from Coco.
And it's not overbearing or abrasive, either. No. It feels very natural. Like, she's an adept writer. She has a great skill, I would say.
Considering a lot of Quillerin's interactions and dialogue are with the cat, and the cat obviously doesn't talk back. It's not a magical cat. It still feels like a very forward-moving story, and even though it's a guy talking to a cat for a couple of chapters, it's not too bad.
No, and you can see, like, the characterization grow. It moves forward. They bond.
Yeah.
And there's like, a really nice relationship that develops there that's kind of unexpected, because we have Quillerin, who is this gruff newspaper man.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you wouldn't think that he would bond with this finicky cat.
On paper, you'd be like, that's a dog guy.
Exactly.
That's a dog man.
He'd be like, where's my Rottweiler?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I need to
Cujo
throw
or whatever.
A tennis ball to Rover. But instead, you know, he ends up cat-sitting Coco. He makes him a toy out of, like, an origami sparrow and a shoestring. He prepares elaborate, like, pâtés and cuts of meat for him.
We don't do that for my cat.
No. Herschel's food comes out of a can. or it's in pellet form.
Yeah.
I guess that's another interesting point. This book was written in 1966, and I was like, wow, did people really, you know, cut up, like, fresh meat for their cats every
day? Did you make two dinners, one for yourself and one for your pet?
Right. And, like, was a litter box literally just a sandbox? Like,
oh, right. Like, could you go out and buy cat litter?
Or did you just buy sand? I don't know.
You can roll up to Home Depot and buy a bag of sand.
Was there Home Depot in 1966?
I don't know. It's so long ago.
I feel like you just went to the local hardware store.
You went to the beach with a shovel.
park. No. This is another episode where people are like, these damn millennials.
But this actually made me want a Siamese cat.
They sound just unbearably charming.
We had one when I was young, and
really?
They are.
Oh.
They're so sweet.
Oh, man.
Really affectionate and smart.
I mean, you know, being that it is a cozy cat mystery, it's not directly stated that Coco is the one that solves the mystery at the heart of the book, but
there's several instances where, so I guess the conceit about Coco is that he is especially refined as a cat and sophisticated.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he reads newspaper headlines, but he reads them backwards.
Yes.
Thus the title of our book.
The Cat Who Could Read Backwards.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very particular, like, Mount Clemens, who is the savage art critic who works for the newspaper, and he's a recluse.
Mm-hmm.
And he stays in his home all the time. He sends his articles out by messenger to the newspaper.
Yeah.
And he has this fantastic, like, super rich,
yeah, like an amazing
art collection inside the brownstone.
Yes.
And, you know, he wears, like, a velvet top coat.
Yeah. Smoking jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Italian loafers.
Right, right. It's like a gourmet cook.
Right.
Very cultured.
Yes.
So naturally his cat absorbs some of that too.
Right. And his cat has its own, like, taste in art.
Yes.
There's a really lovely passage in here where Mount Clemens is describing his cat's taste in art. So Quillerin goes and he meets Mount Clemens for the first time because before that he was like, this guy's fake. He doesn't even exist.
Right, yeah.
He's a bunch of different people.
Right.
And so he goes through his brownstone, meets him, and he's like, oh, dude, you're pretty cool.
Yeah, nice. Mount Clemens is like, do you want to rent the apartment below for me?
Basically for free.
Yeah, the only catch is you have to take care of my cat. He's like, yeah, all right, fine.
Fine, cool.
Yeah.
So Quillerin's there for dinner and they're talking and the cat comes in the room. He's like, whoa, that's a cat. And Mount Clemens says, forgive me for forgetting you have not been formally introduced. He is very fond of grape juice, especially the white, and nothing but the best brand. He is a connoisseur. He sounds like quite a cat, Quillerin said. A remarkable creature. He has cultivated an appreciation for certain periods of art, and although I disagree with his choice, I admire his independence. And then he goes on to say, like, his philosophy on cats, basically. Yes. Like, cat and human interaction, which is, like, very well written, I would say.
Yeah. If it hasn't become clear, this book is, it's a joy to read. It is really entertaining. It's super, like, her writing is so snappy and fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I giggled at a couple parts.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a really enjoyable,
like, a dry humor.
Very
like a
dry
touch of Britishness,
yeah,
in there, for
yeah,
sure.
It's never intentionally trying to be like, boy, this is a real knee slapper, guys.
Slapstick, yeah.
Not loud. But
no. It's very clever.
So clever.
I thought.
Well, another thing with this book, I think we've established our mustachioed main character, Jim Quillerin, and Coco, his incredible Siamese sidekick. One thing I couldn't figure out about this book was where the heck it was supposed to take place.
Yeah. In our cozy rubric, mm-hmm. there's always, like, a cozy town.
Yes.
Or a cozy place, and it's never mentioned in
yeah.
this book. There's hints, like, someone says, oh, I know this guy from Chicago.
Right.
There's a thing like, the blah, 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 Midwest art world.
Yeah, and Mount Clemens, Quillerin's colleague and mysterious art critic friend, he goes to New York a lot, which is interesting because initially when I was reading this book, I'm like, oh, it takes place in New York, but it's sort of like an unnamed metropolitan area.
Right.
That it's like it
big enough
has
to have two newspapers.
Right. An art museum.
Right.
You know, a modern art scene.
I went over, is it Cleveland?
Right.
Is it Indianapolis? I wondered if it was Milwaukee, but Mount Clemens' sister.
Oh, he has a sister in Milwaukee.
And she was going to come down.
Yes.
After he was murdered.
Right.
Mm.
I wondered if perhaps, you know, now knowing that Lillian Jackson Braun was a resident of Detroit, maybe it was supposed to be kind of a stand-in for Detroit.
Right. I wondered that, too.
Yeah.
And then I discovered in her bio, I guess in a later book, it's clarified that it's a town called Pickaxe, Michigan.
Oh.
That's based on
Ann Arbor?
No, there's actually a town called, like, Bad Axe or something in Michigan.
Wow.
Where she actually lived with her first husband.
Oh, wow.
I think it's outside of Detroit because, obviously,
okay.
she works at all these Detroit
right.
organizations.
Yeah.
So my guess would be it's, like, a suburb of Detroit.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So near the action, but not necessarily
not
in a big city. Yeah.
Okay.
Which follows, to some extent, our cozy rubric, that
right.
it's a small town.
Yes.
Although I will say that the street that Mount Clemens lives on is described as pretty gnarly.
He, you know, we mentioned that he's got his art collection and he lives with his cat in, like, a beautiful vintage brownstone. But it's in an area of town that is kind of run down. There's, like, a lot of bums and drug
yeah.
dealers. And
at one time, after he is murdered and, like, the plot is revealed and
mm-hmm.
they're like, oh, he actually planned to murder someone else and dump their body in the alley and
right.
no one would suspect it was him.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say it was a vagrant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that kind of gives you a picture.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, there's, like, this great art world. Like,
right.
art scene happening
yes.
there.
There's
and
galleries.
Yeah.
There's, like, a large city art museum.
Right.
It was kind of hard to figure.
Yeah.
I mean, I was totally picturing, like, a smaller city, but I don't know. Although, I suppose the flight to New York is supposed to be, what, 3 hours from the city?
Something like that.
So I feel like you could be, that would feasibly be somewhere in Michigan.
I think it would have to be less, because it's like, well, 2 hours from Chicago or something, oh, right?
Yeah. Now I really don't know.
Whatever. Maybe planes were slower in the 60s.
It could have been. Who knows? Maybe. Yeah. But, you know, the cozy setting, not necessarily a typical cozy setting. Right. A little more urban, but yeah. still a good backdrop for the mystery.
I would say so.
Definitely still a fertile ground for a cast of wacky side characters.
Oh, man. I'm trying to decide who's my favorite side character. It's not Odd Bunsen.
Oh, God.
The great name.
Yes.
Shitty person.
Terrible guy. Mainly the side characters in this book are Quillerin's colleagues at the newspaper, probably the most important, who we've mentioned briefly before, George Bonifield Mount Clemens.
Yes.
Who is the resident art critic / recluse. He basically lives in his beautiful house with his cat and his art. He sends tapes of his art reviews for people to type. He's a very polarizing figure because he just drags artists that he doesn't like.
Right. He calls their work juvenile, yes, or like an insult to the institution of art.
At one point, the author writes, you know, one of his columns in a chapter, and his review of the artist's exhibition is all about how nice the frames are.
Right.
And how inoffensive the art within the frames is, which is like, ooh, that's just so shady. I love it. So he's a pretty big figure, and a lot of people don't like him, and, you know, rightfully so. He's sort of a jerk to artists he doesn't find, you know, up to his caliber. Quillerin moves in with him. You know, he rents the apartment in his brownstone, and Kat sits for him and realizes, well, maybe he's not such a bad guy. He's just sort of a weird, reclusive dude with very exacting standards when it comes to food, art, music.
Right, he's too cultured for the Midwestern den that he's been isolated to.
And he's got a bit of a tragic past. He has lost one of his hands. It's never, it doesn't specify how, but I guess he was an artist himself and then lost his right hand somehow, so can no longer paint, which is a point of great sadness for him.
True.
That's George Bonifield Mount Clemens, I'd say one of our central eccentric characters.
And then there's a cast of other characters, yes, that sort of buoy the story.
Mm-hmm.
There's Odd Bunsen, which I mentioned. He's the photographer.
He is the photographer at the Daily Fluxion, so often a partner of Quillerin's. He's, again, this book was written in 1966, so I feel like there's a lot of very antiquated, like, gender dynamics at work, as in, like, women didn't really have jobs.
Well, yeah, because within, like, the first two pages, as Quillerin is walking through this newspaper office, he's like, oh, yeah, I walked through and I saw the top typewriters, and I saw, you know, all the papers everywhere. Yeah. And then I saw the inevitable female reporter.
The inevitable female reporter.
Like, excuse me?
Right. Also, this Odd Bunsen character, the photographer, every time he's talking, if someone brings up a woman, he's like, oh, I know her measurements by heart.
That was, like, the first words out of his mouth, was he was like, well, what do you want to know about this character? He's got a smoking hot wife.
Yes.
She's 34, 22, 32.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah, he knows everyone's measurements. He's kind of just like a lecherous, creepy dude that smokes a lot of cigars.
Who is allegedly married?
Right, yes, that was the crazy thing. At one point, you know, another minor character turns up murdered, and Odd Bunsen is like, you know, if I was murdered, I'd want my wife to be mourning me a lot harder, not going out for dinner. And I was like,
let her live her life if, like, that's how she's going to mourn.
You got married? Like, you're disgusting.
Yeah. First point.
Yeah.
Someone married you.
Right.
Ugh.
Definitely a lot of, like, good old boys with the newspaper.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different artists who were described. There's, like, the Halapes.
Yes.
Who, is it Cal Halape?
It is Cal and his wife.
Yeah.
I think she was
Sandy.
Sandy.
Sandy or Sandra.
Something.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Cal Halape paints, like, big eyes is what I got from it. Like, curly-haired children.
Yeah, with tragic, giant eyes.
Yeah. And he's, like, a boy genius who's, like, an executive at a big advertising agency. And so his work is viewed as, like, rather commercial.
Right.
Rather pedestrian.
Mount Clemens, not a fan.
Not a fan. Not a fan. Mm-mm. But Halipay is super rich.
Yeah.
So whatever. Mm-hmm. He can buy his status.
He can do what he wants. I would say most of, like, the really gross antiquated sexism comes when people are referring to his wife, Sandra.
Right.
Because she's usually referred to either by her measurements or the fact that she is vaguely oriental looking.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, that's...
Quote.
It's not how we describe people
I
in
love
2017.
It. I love it. Sarcastically. Yeah. When Halipay is, like, giving the grand tour of his house, his, like, villa, and he's like, yes, you met my wife. She's Oriental. We decorated the place to match her looks. Like,
ooh,
what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Very dated with that reference. Not great.
Yeah. And then there's a scene later where Quillerin takes Sandy out to a dinner at a steakhouse.
Yes.
And the way that he describes her laugh is, it struck me as, like, incredibly mean.
Oh, no.
Yeah. There's, like, he describes her as, like, the more she talks to him, the more she's, like, cackling.
Yes. Oh, she does have a cackle.
Yeah.
They use that a lot.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, really? Right. Why don't you just call her Shrell?
Yeah. Like, Tom Selleck, what are you doing? I feel like, you know, by and large, and I don't know if it's because this was a product of the late 60s, the women in this book kind of get a short shift. The other main female character is Zoe Lambreth, who is an artist herself and the wife of Earl Lambreth, owner of the Lambreth Gallery, who Mount Clemens is really into, but she's like, I'm not feeling him, and Quillerin kind of falls under her spell, too. He loves her knees.
I saw that.
Yeah, at one point
he's like very attracted. Oh, the dimple beneath her knee when he's describing him.
Yeah.
Like, what dimple is that?
I don't know, but he's into her knees.
Yeah,
and, like, her soulful brown eyes or whatever.
It's an unusual fetish.
Yeah, so she's, you know, like the soft-spoken dame who's been wronged in this.
Right, her husband is murdered in their gallery that they own.
Yes.
And she's, like, beside herself. And eventually, like, there's this whole subplot where Mount Clemens was trying to woo her, and maybe there was, like, a romantic entanglement.
Right.
She's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
No, it's not like that.
I can't. Yeah.
I think also, if we're talking about unfortunate sexism.
Oh boy, yeah.
There's a treatment of Zoe Lambreth's childhood friend, Butchie.
Yeah. Oh god. You think they could have given this woman a name, but.
She's a lady welder, sculptor who works with metal.
Yeah, she's described as having, like, a very mannish figure and short hair.
Right.
Which, you know, basically all of her descriptions go down as pretty much what you'd expect for the 60s, which is to say, like, holy smokes, this is a really lousy way of treating, like, the one queer character in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. she's portrayed as, like, volatile and slightly violent and, like, overly needy and overbearing.
And, like, obsessed with her best friend, Zoe.
Right.
Yeah.
And Zoe doesn't know how to, like, turn her off.
Right.
Like, it's a very poor treatment.
Yeah, it's kind of like, not
you
good.
You named her Butchie?
Really? Like, of all the names
Anything.
You could have given this character, you're like, Butchie.
Elizabeth.
Right.
Maria.
Yeah.
Any other name.
Any other name.
Any other name.
But, nope.
Nope.
So, some unfortunate products of the time, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I would imagine. Like, you wouldn't...
Well,
you'd
have the good sense in this day and age, like, not to do any of that.
Right. Like, just slightly more decency.
Yeah, you would hope.
Yeah.
So, I gotta say, we've covered off on our main character.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We started this episode talking a little bit about the comparison, right, between Karen Ann Golden's story and this series. And we want to know if there was any overlap. And the only overlap I noticed was apparently, according to these two books, Siamese cats have an unusual reaction to dead bodies.
Ooh.
Yeah. So in the Cats That Surf the Web.
Yes.
In the first chapter, when we have the first dead body, the passage reads like this. An eerie shaft of light shone through the window, revealing a large Siamese cat, which had arched its back. Now it was swaying from side to side in some kind of strange dance. The cat's eyes were red and almost seemed to glow. It murmured a long, low growl. And it's, like, next to a dead body while it's doing this.
Gary.
Gary. Oh. Sorry, Gary.
R.I.P.
And then later on when, what's her face? Mrs. Something or Other. The housekeeper dies.
Oh,
yeah. And she's found in the basement.
I don't remember
her name. Mary. Mary, maybe.
Mrs. Housekeeper.
Okay, when Mrs. Housekeeper is found dead in the basement, and Catherine
Cat Scandal
opens the door and she lets her Siamese cat Scout down. Scout ran past her and went directly to the body. She arched her back and, with all four legs stiffened, began bouncing up and down in some kind of bizarre dance, with her eyes fixed on the corpse.
Ooh.
Right?
Okay, so we got kind of a dancing Siamese.
Right. Apparently, they go into, like, Halloween cat mode and, like, bounce around the dead body.
All right.
So, in The Cat Who Could Read Backwards, Quillerin lets Coco out the back door.
Yes.
And they go down. They're like, something curious out here. Yes. Where's Mount Clemens? They go near the back gate, and they see Mount Clemens' body on the cement there. And Quillerin is flashing his flashlight around, trying to look for clues, being like, holy Moses.
Yeah, there's a dead guy on my patio.
Oh, boy.
It's my landlord.
Oh, boy. This isn't good.
Nope.
And within the patio, the only movement was a pale shadow just beyond the flashlight's range. It moved in circles. It was the cat, behaving oddly, performing some private ritual. With back arched and tail stiff and ears laid back, Cao Ko Kung walked around and around and around.
Ooh. Karen.
Oh. I see some stark similarities. Unless there's just something about Siamese cats and murder that I don't know.
I'm not really well-versed in murder or Siamese cats, so I cannot make an educated statement either way.
I don't think there's any way that we could prove that that is how Siamese cats behave to murder.
True. Very true. Although it does raise an eyebrow.
Yeah.
Yes, but that Karen Ann Golden may have read these books. Although the quality of her writing is so deeply lacking that...
So far below.
Yeah, that even if she had just, like, plagiarized some things word for word,
I kind of would have preferred that.
I would have, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, The Cat Who Could Read Backwards. Delightful read.
I want to go back in time and empower Lillian Jackson Braun
to
change the ending of this book.
We gotta talk about this flippin' ending. Holy smokes.
Okay.
So...
Go on.
All right. I feel like it's been a common thread in a lot of these cozy cat mystery books that we've read that the culprit, you know, whoever committed the murder or whatever, usually comes out of left field within, like, the last 30 or 40 pages of the book. It's never like, oh, this has been set up for the whole book. It's like, oh, it was actually a cousin that wanted to get the estate. Or, like, it was actually a housekeeper who was... you know, sad that they weren't going to get the money, or it was a lady whose son got bullied and she was taking revenge. I mean, it's all like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Who is this person?
Right.
What?
In a properly laid mystery, you get, like, hints at the beginning.
Right.
There's clues that the smart reader can pick up on and try to put together themselves. And usually, like, maybe they don't get it. Because yeah. that's actually more satisfying if you get super close.
Right.
And then you're wrong at the end. And you're like, oh no, you're that like, solution made so much more sense than what I put together.
Right, right.
But in this case.
In this case, it was truly the cozy cat mystery trope of being like, surprise! Here's the murderer!
Someone you never expected.
It's a character that literally only came in on like the last four pages. Which it does tie into. This title, The Cat Who Could Read Backwards, essentially what happens is, you know, throughout the book, Earl Lambreth, the husband of Zoe Lambreth, the gallery owner, he's dead. You know, there's this, like, outsider artist that makes these weird sculptures. He's dead. And then Bonifield Mount Clemens, he ends up dead as well.
And in the background mentioned, there's this this well-regarded Italian artist
right.
called Scrano.
Yes.
And he is like an abstract artist. He paints triangles.
Right. And like the Lambreth Gallery stocked his work and Mount Clemens positively reviewed his work.
Right.
So, but he's never a character that you meet, you know.
He's this mysterious Italian figure.
Right. I mean,
he
lives in Tuscany somewhere. He's not in this little city.
And he gets too sick to continue painting his paintings,
right.
allegedly.
So, you know, of course, all of his work's on the upswing, and the Lambreth Gallery has a bunch of Scranos. So you're starting, as you read the book, you're like, all right, well, you know, initially it seems like Butchie Bolton could be the one who murdered Earl Lambreth because he was a lousy husband to Zoe, and she's secretly in love with Zoe. But then, you know, this other sculptor turns up dead, and it was like, it was a protege of Zoe's, but also a competitor. But then Mount Clemens turns up dead, and then you find out, like, Mount Clemens was, like, trying to get with Zoe, but she didn't like him because he was a creepy old man, and she was married to a guy that she didn't love. Like, oh, crap, is Zoe the murderer?
And I wanted Zoe to be the murderer. I mean, wanted her to have taken that chisel off of the table and stabbed her husband.
She had the most to gain by everyone getting murdered. Like, she would be the owner of the gallery. You know, she wouldn't have to worry about currying Mount Clemens' favor to get good reviews of her artwork.
She had Quillerin in her pocket.
Yes, Quillerin was like, she's hot, I love her. So, you know, she was the one to gain the most from the murder. However, on literally the last four pages of the book, Quillerin and Coco the Siamese go down into Mount Clemens' studio because, you know, he had some paintings that he had been working on himself, realize that it's full of Scrano paintings and some of them are missing. And then Quillerin realizes that Coco is reading backwards.
Scrano, backwards, yeah.
Which is O-N-A-R-X.
Which turns into O-N-A-R-X.
Yeah.
And there's, like, these mysterious robot
paintings,
portraits.
Right.
Yeah.
It turns out it's a man named Oscar Narks who painted the robot portraits because he was complicit in Mount Clemens' art world fraud scheme.
Yeah.
Because Scrano wasn't really an Italian artist. It was just Mount Clemens dictating his vision to Oscar Narks. It made no sense!
And then suddenly Narks is there and he's trying to
steal his paintings back. And then he's like, uh-oh, someone's down here. I better murder Quillerin. But Coco the cat kind of like jumps on his face and mauls him. And Quillerin is able to knock him out with a flashlight.
But, like, we literally never see his name. And I had to go to Google Books and look at this online and do a search of this book to be like, where is Narks mentioned? Because I thought I had missed it.
I also did. I was like, oh, shoot. You know, we meet a lot of sort of minor artsy characters.
Yeah.
Like, was it mentioned in passing? Like,
I thought it was at one of the parties he went to.
Or like, oh, you know, the disgraced gallery curator's pen name is Narks. Like, it's none of those people.
It's just no one.
It's a random guy. Last four pages of the book.
I know.
Which is a really disappointing ending because there were, like, really a lot of kind of loose threads that were starting to come together that was like, I don't know, I think Zoe Lambreth is not as...
And I think it would have made Zoe Lambreth really powerful.
Yes.
If she had been the one to unravel herself from her right. husband and from this romantic entanglement that she yes. never sought in the first place.
Right, right.
And if she could have been the one angling to yeah. free herself from this situation.
Eliminating her artistic competition.
Right.
Like, but no, she just ends up being like, oh, that poor dame whose husband died.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like we have kind of a conspiracy theory.
We
do.
We have a theory.
I think that it was originally meant to be Zoe Lambreth who murdered everyone, and she was the criminal mastermind, and I feel like some shitty 60s editor was like, what? No! You can't have
a woman!
Can't have a lady murderer! Not,
no one will buy that.
Not doing stabbings! Poisonings, maybe!
A stabbing is very violent.
Too violent for a weak woman's constitution. She needs to find another husband.
Your lady readers won't appreciate this.
Right.
Like,
it was like another person picked up the last 10 pages of the book and wrote it.
Yeah.
Like a completely different person.
It was like Lillian Jackson Braun was forced to rewrite the ending yes. and didn't get a chance to go back and insert this character right. into the beginning ever.
Because there are so many places he could have came in.
Anywhere.
I mean, like, there were some of these minor characters that were mentioned, like, you know, that guy Cal Halapay, the wealthy painter that painted, like, the
Or the,
commercial art.
There's, like, the Rush Walters or something? The
yes.
Rush Walters?
There's, like, there's at least half a dozen characters that could have been inserted that were, you know, part of this fabric of this, you know.
Coolerin has a dozen conversations right. with Mount Clemens where Mount Clemens mm-hmm. could have mentioned his New York agent, Oscar Narks.
Right, exactly. Or like his protege or a talented yeah. young painter he knows. It never happened.
Never.
And, you know, I get that reading Scrano backwards, you sort of get, oh, Narks. But not to the point that it was like
it's a weak
it was an actual
connection.
Person. I don't know. I like our theory that it was supposed to be Zoe Lambreth and some editor at, you know, who published this? Joke Mystery.
That's what I have to It was later picked up by Penguin, I think.
Oh, Penguin. I've got penguin.com on the back of mine.
Okay, there we go.
And that some, like, crummy 1960s dude at Penguin chewing on a cigar was like, I don't know. I don't believe this broad could murder three other men. I think you gotta change it up.
Yeah.
I also think that's kind of why the protagonist in this book was a, like, mustachioed newsman in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
The tables have certainly turned since then because
yes.
all of our protagonists are women now.
Right.
And by and large, I would say except for, what's her face in the first book? Savannah.
Yes.
I would say there are elements of strong, independent women.
Right.
And I feel confident that we will get closer and closer
yes.
to that penultimate, like, strong female character that we so want
right.
in one of these books.
Yes, yes.
But it's certainly not here. And it's shocking because Lillian Jackson Braun is such a talented writer.
She's such a good writer.
Imagine what she could do with a female character.
I know.
She gave, like, agency to.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I honestly wonder if, because of the time that this was written, it was like, you've got to write a dude as your main character, and, like, the murderer can't be a lady. It's got to be another dude.
Well, and even later, like, what, she picked it back up in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And I think either she was just so far into the series that she mm-hmm. wanted to see it through, or, like, there could be any number of reasons
yeah.
why she chose to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Or there could be strong female murderers in later books. We don't know. We haven't read that far.
We haven't. But, you know, if we do and we're reading one of these that was published in, like, the mid-90s.
Yeah, could be.
I hope we get some lady murderers.
I hope so, too. I do not buy Oscar Narks.
No! Who, like, just shows up out of nowhere.
Nowhere!
And they're like, oh, yeah, of course. It turns out Mount Clemens was actually defrauding the art world that he loved so much. And,
right.
And Oscar Narks was just a pair of hands because Mount Clemens was missing a hand, so he couldn't paint. Like, what?
That doesn't fall at all into Mount Clemens's character.
No!
Like, he loved art.
He was so sincere about
it. He loved art, I think, more than he loved money. Like, he needed money to get art.
But the only reason he wrote about art was so he could get money to buy more art.
Right.
He wasn't about defrauding it. Like,
I don't think so.
He had no love in his life outside of his love of art.
The ending does not make sense.
I kind of hate men to begin with, so I'm just gonna blame it on the guy.
It is the season.
I'm just gonna blame it on...
We are at a cultural turning point.
I'm just gonna blame it on, like, a shitty editor in 1966 who's like, I don't know, can't put any ladies as murderers or main characters. Who's gonna take care of their kids? Who's gonna make dinner for their husbands?
Right.
I don't know. In the meantime, we'll be back in another 2 weeks.
For our 10th episode.
Our 10th episode.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man, guys.
It's going to be fun.
We've got something cool planned.
We do.
So get ready for episode 10. In the meantime, continue to dismantle the patriarchy. we love you.
We love you, kittens.
Yes. Yep. Hit us up on social media because we want to hear from you.
Rate, review, and subscribe. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.